That's right, said Kelly. I don't know the exact date when it opened.
I can get Bogart to check on that,
said Jameson. Decker said, and when we find out when he was there and what he was doing, we're going to come back here and have it out with that guy.
But he's a really old man, Decker,
said Jameson. Yeah, I know, and right now he's also the best shot we have to solve this case. As they walked outside, Kelly said, what the hell is going on here? I don't know, said Decker, but we're getting closer to them.
Okay, but let's just hope they don't get us before we get them,
said Jameson ominously. Chapter 39. And Bogart said he was on it? Asked Decker. He and Jameson were walking to a restaurant where they were having dinner with Baker and Caroline Dawson. Decker had changed into another pair of pants, a clean white shirt, and his worn corduroy jacket with elbow patches, which constituted his most elegant set of clothes. The weather had changed, the temps had dipped into the 60s, and the humidity had vanished. Jameson had on a dark skirt that hit at her knee, ankle boots with zippers on the side and chunky heels, and a white blouse with a jean jacket over it.
Yes, I talked to him just a bit ago, and since it has to do with the military, he was going to call Harper Brown.
Harper Brown was with the DIA, or Defense Intelligence Agency, and she had worked with them on a previous case. Good. Anything on Kramer and why she's important to the feds?
No. I asked him, and he said he had come up empty. Boy, the wind really makes it chilly,
said Jameson as she pulled her jean jacket tighter. 2 days ago, you were complaining about the heat.
As I recall, it wasn't just me complaining.
As they drew closer to the restaurant, Decker said, so dinner tonight, what am I supposed to do? She looked at him, not in surprise, because she had more or less expected this query.
Well, first of all, try to enjoy yourself. It's been an intense few days, and even you need to recharge your batteries. Next, be supportive of Stan and Caroline. Don't go in there thinking that she's trying to replace your sister.
And if I say something stupid?
Just think about what you're going to say before you say it.
Easy for you to say, muttered Decker. An etched bronze sign next to the front door of the restaurant read, Maddie's.
That's her mother's name,
said Jameson. No coincidence there, obviously, replied Decker. Maddie's was on the first floor of a restored brick building with a pair of flickering gas lanterns on either side of the polished wood door. Jameson glanced at the fiery lanterns and quipped,
great, more methane.
Dawson and Baker were at the bar having a drink. Baker was dressed like Decker, khakis, white shirt, and a jacket that had seen better days. Dawson was glammed up in a turquoise dress with a leather belt, black tights, and low heels. Her hair was down around her shoulders. They moved over to their table and sat down. Jameson looked around at the interior space that appeared both brand new and very old, but was fleshed out with thought and in spots even artistry.
Well, this is really beautiful. Didn't expect to see something like this here.
She shot Dawson an embarrassed glance.
I didn't mean it that way. Sorry.
Decker gave her a funny look, leaned over, and whispered, think before you say something. Dawson smiled in understanding at Jameson's remark.
No, I get that. This is actually my baby. What?
Exclaimed Jameson. Baker grinned and said, she runs the whole place, not her dad. We spoke to your father, said Decker.
Why did you need to talk to him?
Just routine questioning.
So this is really your restaurant?
Said Jameson, deftly changing the subject.
My dad technically owns it, but I worked out the financials, did the planning, the build-out, the hiring, everything from the utensil choices to the drapes to the types of gin in the bar. The place has a website and a social media platform, and we also cater and do special events.
Jameson stared around the crowded space.
Well, if this is any indication, you've got a real winner. We're booked up for the next 3 months, in fact. It's pretty much the only fine dining choice in town. I got the chef from Napa Valley.
Baker added with a chuckle, we only got a table tonight because she owns the place. She laughed and gripped his big hand.
Thing is, my dad thought I was crazy. He said, don't try to make this town into something it's not.
Meaning? Said Decker.
My father will always see London as a one-horse place that will never rise above that status, even with all the wealth being generated by the fracking. But I see things differently. I think we're past the boom and bust cycles. People aren't just coming here to work and get rich and then get out. They're coming to stay. I know the weather can be a real challenge, but it is in lots of places, and warmer spots are a short flight away. The point is, if you have nice things here, people will want to stay and put down roots. And North Dakotans are nice people, salt of the earth types.
I'm a Midwesterner, said Decker, so I agree with that.
And with the money that's here now, people can both afford and appreciate the amenities and service like I've tried to offer here. I think it's terrific,
said Jameson. Baker raised his glass. To terrific things. He nodded at Dawson. And terrific people. After they ordered their dinners, Dawson asked about the investigation.
I heard there was another murder and that Hal Parker went missing.
That's right, Pamela Ames. She used to live at the Brothers Colony,
said Jameson. But why would someone have wanted to kill her? Asked Baker.
Could be wrong place, wrong time, if Parker was the target. But why would he be a target?
Asked Dawson. Decker said, did either of you know Pamela Ames? Baker shook his head, but Dawson said,
I worked with Milton Ames on some business matters. I knew Pamela was his daughter, but I wasn't friends with her.
But why was Ames at Hal Parker's in the first place? Asked Baker.
They might have known each other,
said Jameson vaguely, shooting a glance at Decker. Shifting gears, she said to Dawson,
we went to see your father at his home. It's beautiful. After Mom died, we both needed something to occupy our minds. Since we weren't moving to France without her, I decided building a new home for Dad would be a good thing. Give him something to focus on. He loves getting into the details. He just finished it. Took nearly 2 years with crews working around the clock.
And how did you cope? Asked Decker. She smiled sadly.
I buried myself in work, too.
Your mother died in a blizzard, I understand, said Decker. Dawson nodded and rubbed at a ring on her pinky.
From carbon monoxide poisoning in her car,
she said in a low, halting voice. What was she doing out in a blizzard in the first place? Asked Decker.
Alice Pritchard, an elderly neighbor, had called. Her power was out, and she was in trouble. She had health problems.
Why didn't she just call 911? Asked Decker.
My mom would have gotten there faster than the 911 folks. And we had a backup generator, so Alice would have been fine at our house. It had happened before, and each time Alice would call us.
But your mother never made it to Alice's, said Decker.
No, and Alice died, too.
My God,
said Jameson. Decker said, if the neighbor died, how'd you know she had called your mom and that was the reason she was out in the blizzard?
My mom had texted me when Alice called, but with the time difference, I didn't see the text until the following morning. The first I knew about it was when they found her in the car after the blizzard had passed. I'm very sorry,
said Jameson as Baker tenderly patted Dawson's shoulder. There was a moment of silence until Decker said awkwardly, Your dad said you'll be running the world before long. Jameson eyed Decker nervously, but before she could say anything, Baker chimed in. Daddy's perfect little girl. Decker noted that Dawson did not seem happy about this remark. And we understand you had a brother? He asked, drawing another stern look from Jameson. She said,
I'm sure Caroline would rather talk about something else.
Dawson coughed and took a drink of her water.
No, it's okay. Yes, my brother Hugh. We called him Junior. He died.
Decker said, Joe Kelly told us he and your father didn't see eye to eye on things, but he wouldn't elaborate. Dawson gazed at Decker with an intensity that made him feel uncomfortable.
Good old Joe. He does like to keep things close to the vest.
Was that wrong of him?
Asked Jameson.
No, I suppose he was just trying to shield the family from undue attention. Joe's always been loyal that way. The fact is, my brother was gay, and my father had a big problem with that. He cut him out of the will, out of the business, out of his life. In the end, Junior couldn't live with it, I guess, so he decided to end his life. He took a bunch of pills. I was the one who found him.
She dabbed at her eyes with her napkin. Damn, Caroline, I had no idea, said Baker.
No reason you should have known. I cared deeply for my brother. We were very close.
That must have made things difficult between you and your father, said Decker.
We didn't speak for about a year after Junior died. But then we lost Mom, and we decided as the only family left we needed to seek a truce. So we did.
Do you think the truce will hold? Asked Decker. She tapped her ring against the wood, as though for luck.
I don't think I have a choice,
she replied. Decker said, Well, like Stan said, I think your father does see you as his perfect little girl. Dawson said firmly,
I don't think there's any such thing.
Chapter 40. When Decker and Jameson returned to the hotel, they found someone waiting for them. Shane McClellan rose from a seat in the lobby and came over to them. He was dressed in jeans and an untucked gray shirt. His hair was slicked back, and he had a few days' worth of stubble on his face. He gazed anxiously from one to the other. Hal Parker? He began.
What about him? Said Decker.
Heard somebody took him and left a gal dead in his shed.
What's it to you? Asked Decker.
Hal was one of my best buddies. We would go hunting all the time.
We actually saw a picture of you with him at his house on one of those hunting trips,
said Jameson.
Do you know what happened to him? Decker said, We're working on it. Mind if we ask you some questions now that we know you two were friends?
Sure, whatever I can do to help. Decker led them over to a seating area next to the lobby. When they were settled in, he said,
When was the last time you saw him?
2 days after he found that woman's body. I went out to his place to pick up some stuff and he told me about it. It shook him up bad.
Did he tell you about the wolf he was tracking?
Yeah, he was hunting it when he found the lady.
Did Parker know a woman named Pamela Ames?
Shane's brow furrowed. No, not that I know of. Is she the gal they found dead there?
She was. Now, what we found might point to Ames having been there for paid sex. Knowing Parker, do you think that's plausible?
How? A hooker? No way. Why the hell would you even think that?
We found some evidence that suggests it might have been the case, said Decker vaguely.
Shane folded his arms over his chest and looked at them stubbornly. Well, I'll never believe that. Hal liked to hunt and fish and drink his beer, and that was about it.
When you saw Hal, was he worried about anything?
Not that he mentioned. He was upset about the lady and all, but that was it. We were planning on doing some hunting soon. He was excited about that.
I'm surprised you have time, considering all the things you're doing with your father,
interjected Jameson.
He seems to keep you pretty busy.
He'd keep me busy every minute of the day if I let him, but I got a secret weapon.
What's that?
Asked Jameson. I don't give a shit about what he really cares about, which is making money from pulling oil out of the dirt.
You have a farm? Said Decker. Near the Air Force Station?
That's right.
You know the brothers?
Yeah, good folks.
You go out there at all?
Sure. They do metal fabrication. We use some of what they make in our fracking operations. Plus, they have a lot of trucks, and we pay them to haul stuff for us.
Did you know Irene Kramer?
No, I didn't. Jameson said,
Are you and Caroline friends?
We grew up together, me, her, and Joe Kelly. Went to high school together. We were sort of inseparable back then.
Right, Kelly told us some of that.
Joe and I were on the football team. He was the starting QB, and I was his best receiver. A grin slowly spread over Shane's features. I caught 45 touchdown passes from him over two seasons, and we won the state title both years. And not to sound boastful or anything, but we were really popular in high school. Best times of my life. Got up every day with a smile.
And now?
Said Jameson. Now we don't see each other much. Caroline's busy with running all her dad's stuff, and Joe being a cop, he doesn't keep regular hours. He added wistfully, sort of miss those days. Long gone now.
But you like Caroline,
said Jameson. He looked down. Hell, everybody likes Caroline. Used to have these fantasies that we got hitched and had a bunch of kids. He paused. She and Joe even dated in high school. Thought for a while they were going to get married. He grinned weakly. Only thing I ever hated about the guy. Caroline seemed to like him more than me. He paused. Me and Joe used to be best friends, together all the time.
What happened?
Asked Jameson. Life happened, said Shane sadly. We're still buds, just not like before. Nothing's like it was before, he added wistfully. That tends to be the case with everybody, opined Decker.
We just came from dinner with Caroline,
said Jameson. Is that right? At her newfangled place?
Yes, Maddie's, named after her mom.
Damn shame what happened to her.
Yes, it was a real tragedy,
noted Jameson. So Joe became a cop, Caroline went to college, and you joined the army, said Decker. That's right. How long were you in? Long enough to do and see things I'll remember till the day I die, Shane said sharply. Don't get me wrong, I was proud to do my duty, but I was glad to put it behind me. I had buddies who died or lost limbs. After that, I came back here. You ever see any strange activity over at the Air Force complex? Strange? Just anything out of the ordinary. Not really. They got a lot of security over there. Locals call the radar over there the eye in the sky. Used to look for nukes, so I heard. Things been there since before my dad was born. You ever been over there? Nope. Why all the questions about them? Just routine. So what can I do to help find Hal? You've helped us by telling us what you did. So that's it? Nothing more I can do? Not unless you have any information about who might have killed Irene Kramer and Pamela Ames. Shane shook his head. I guess I can see why not a damn thing gets done in D.C. Jameson said,
We're working hard on this, Shane, but it's not easy.
Yeah, okay, I guess, he said offhandedly. Well, see you around. He walked off. Decker said, He was pretty certain that Hal Parker would never hire a prostitute, but I think that... Decker had stopped so abruptly and looked so out of sorts that Jameson snapped.
Decker, what is it?
We've got to go. He turned and started hustling to the door.
Go? Go where?
He called over his shoulder. To see a body. Chapter 41. The doors to the funeral home were locked, and Decker had to pound on the wood for a full 30 seconds until they saw someone cautiously approach the front entrance. It was a thin young man dressed as a custodian and holding a mop.
Yes?
He said from behind the door glass, his features anxious. Jameson laid her federal badge against the glass and said,
FBI, open this door now.
The man dropped his mop and nearly fell over. He fumbled with the door lock and then jumped back as Decker bulled past him.
What's this all about? Cried out the man. This is a funeral home, for Pete's sake. Show some respect. Hey, where are you going?
Neither of them answered him. Decker quickly led Jameson to the morgue room and opened the door. He looked at the wall of drawers where the bodies were kept until he saw the name Ames on a note card taped to one of them. He opened the door and slid out the gurney. Decker lifted off the sheet, revealing the naked body of Pamela Ames.
What are we looking for, Decker?
Said Jameson anxiously.
Where do you think her clothes are? He said distractedly.
I would imagine back at the police station in the evidence locker. I know that Kelly collected them for analysis.
Call Kelly up and tell him to bring all that over here.
Okay, but I'd like to tell him a reason.
Tell him that Ames, and not Parker, may have been the real target.
Jameson had worked with Decker long enough not to question a statement like that. She went off to a corner to make the call. Decker looked over the body and then glanced around and spotted a file folder on another table. He picked it up and leafed through it, quickly finding that it contained Walt Southern's preliminary notes on the post-mortem he'd performed on Ames. He read through all the notes and then walked back to the body, carrying the folder with him. Jameson joined him.
He's getting the clothes and heading over. He was at the station, so it won't be long.
Decker nodded absently as Jameson looked down at the body.
So what did you mean by Ames being the target?
Look at the body, Alex. Lividity sets as quickly as 30 minutes after death, and then permanently after about 2 hours. Southern gave us that speech before with respect to Kramer's postmortem. Not that we didn't already know that.
Right, he did.
Decker pointed to the body's waist, chest, and thigh areas.
Once liver mortis is completed and the blood settles, if the body comes into contact with a mechanical pressure of any kind, blood can't collect there and the skin remains pale. Now, we found Ames facing forward in a prone position over the handlebars of the ATV. After she died, gravity would have forced the blood in that direction once her heart stopped. But even before lividity was fixed, the tight clothes she was wearing would act as multiple pressure cuffs. But do you see any paleness in those areas? Because the blood couldn't get there?
No, they're purplish and red.
She glanced sharply up at him.
Which means she was killed and then sometime later she was dressed in the clothes she was found in. Did Southern note any of that in his report?
No, he didn't.
Then Ames wasn't a hooker.
They tried to fool us by clothing her like that.
How does that connect to Kramer?
Asked Jameson.
She certainly would have known Kramer from the colony. What if when she left the colony, she went to Kramer for help, a place to stay, to get some money? And what if Kramer confided in her something that disturbed Ames? Then Kramer ends up dead and is found by Parker. What would Ames have likely done in that situation?
Understanding broke over Jameson's features.
You mean Ames might have gone out there to ask Parker about his finding the body? Maybe hoping he could tell her something that would help her figure out what had happened? Especially if, like you said, Kramer had already told Ames something disturbing.
Only someone got wind of it and went there to stop it. And as we saw, they obviously succeeded.
He glanced at the report again.
And you remember the bottle of wine and two glasses?
What about them?
Ames's stomach contents show no signs of any wine. So how could that be if she had been drinking wine with Parker?
So that was staged?
It was all staged.
So why kill her and take Parker?
To make us think exactly what we did. That he was the target and she wasn't. That she was wrong place, wrong time only. And they couldn't let Parker go after that. Not if he saw what they did to Ames.
Jameson let out a breath.
Damn. So where's Parker then?
I really wouldn't count on us ever finding him alive.
God, Decker, this is really spiraling out of control.
They're trying to tie up loose ends, Alex, but that cuts both ways. Every time they do stuff like this, they risk leaving something behind that will allow us to catch them.
But how many more people have to die before we do catch them?
Decker stared down at Ames's body and didn't answer, because he had no answer to give. Chapter 42. Kelly showed up with the clothes and lots of questions. While Jameson filled him in on Decker's deductions, Decker took the clothes and laid them over Ames's body in the exact same manner in which she had worn them. When Jameson was finished giving Kelly the rundown, Decker said,
"Look at where the clothes drop on her."
They clustered around the body as Decker methodically pointed out the different strike points.
Here, here, and here. Lividity's fixed. There's no way the skin and blood pool presents like what we're seeing right now if she were wearing those clothes when she was killed. They were so tight, they actually cut into her skin, there, and there.
Kelly nodded enthusiastically.
She was dressed in something else. Then they changed her into these clothes to make it look like the encounter was paid sex.
Then they took her real clothes and deposited her in the shed on the ATV.
And took Parker. You think he's dead? Asked Kelly. Decker shrugged. I wouldn't bet against it. Did Walt Southern have access to these clothes?
Of course. He had to examine them for trace and then for purposes of the post-mortem. You know that.
Yeah, I know that. I just wonder if he does.
Decker picked up the skirt and one of the shoes. He eyed the sizes on both and then eyeballed Ames's body.
Alex, help me out here. Would these sizes be right for someone like Ames?
Jameson looked at the skirt and shoe sizes and then tried to put one of the shoes on Ames's foot.
This is two sizes too big. No way she's walking around in these. And I'd say the skirt and top are at least two sizes too small. I get that she might have wanted it tight, but not that tight.
I thought that when I noted how deeply they had cut into her body, said Decker. That would not have been too comfortable.
They might have killed her before they even got to Parker's,
suggested Jameson.
Then drove her out there and then dressed her.
Which would explain the lividity being fixed and also the absence of blood on the ATV and in the shed. Whoever was behind this knew something about forensics. Look at Kramer's post-mortem, but not the finer points, like liver mortis.
Are you folks going to make a habit of barging in here at all hours?
They turned to see Walt Southern standing at the door. His wife was beside him. Decker turned to face them and said,
I take it the guy who let us in called you.
Southern entered the room and his wife followed. He saw the clothes draped over Ames's corpse.
What's going on? He asked. Why are those things on the body?
Just verifying some details that weren't in your report, said Decker.
You saying I missed something?
There was nothing in your report about the lividity presentation.
Southern came forward and picked up the report Decker had set on a table.
I hadn't finished it yet.
Regardless, it should have been in the preliminary report.
Okay, what about the lividity?
It was off. She was killed earlier than you said, and then after lividity was set, she was dressed in those clothes and placed in the shed on the ATV.
That's only speculation on your part.
It's a conclusion based on the evidence.
Liz spoke up.
Anything else that struck you?
Well, if there is, there's no need for you to know, said Decker bluntly. Your husband provides us information based on the forensics of the body. We don't keep him apprised of our investigation, even if you trust the person doing the post.
Decker fell silent and stared Southern down. Southern dropped the file on the table and gazed pointedly at Decker.
I really don't like your attitude.
I've never felt the need to be liked by anybody.
We're all on the same team.
This came from Liz Southern, who had advanced farther into the room and now stood, in solidarity, it seemed, next to her husband.
My confidence has been shaken in my teammate.
Decker moved closer to the couple and leaned down.
Maybe you can help me out on that.
If you're accusing me of some sort of negligence, began Southern in a loud voice.
No, I'm not accusing you of negligence.
Well, that's something.
Because negligence implies a mistake was unwittingly made.
Liz Southern sucked in a breath while her husband glowered at Decker.
What exactly are you saying, Decker? Asked Kelly.
You want to tell us, Walt? Asked Decker. I mean, one big mistake. Okay, that happens, if rarely. But two? Now that's what I call a pattern.
I'm not going to stand around and listen to this garbage, exclaimed Southern. You can talk to my lawyer.
But then he took a provocative step toward Decker, his face flushed and his features angry. Kelly quickly stepped between the two men.
Now just hold on. This is getting way out of hand.
He turned to Southern.
But Walt, there are some weird things going on here. Now, I'm not directly accusing you.
Oh, shut the hell up,
roared Southern. He turned and stalked out of the room. All eyes turned to his wife, who looked wobbly on her feet.
Liz, said Kelly, what is going on here?
Walt is upset, naturally.
She flashed an angry look at Decker.
Who could blame him with all the foul things this big jerk is implying?
I'm implying nothing, said Decker. I'm saying that your husband intentionally misstated the post-mortem results in order to interfere with our investigation.
That is a damnable lie.
Who made him do it? Persisted Decker.
I have no idea what you're talking about. My husband would never do such a thing.
They all jerked when they heard the shot, which was immediately followed by something hitting the floor. They rushed out of the room, with Jameson in the lead. Down the hall, a door stood partially open. Jameson pushed it open all the way and hurried inside. Then she stopped as the others piled in behind her. This was apparently Walt Southern's office, with diplomas and certificates on the wall. A desk was set by one wall. The high-backed chair behind it had been pushed back against the wall. Jameson, Kelly, and Decker peered around the corner of the desk. On the floor was Walt Southern. The gun he'd used to shoot himself in the mouth was on the carpet next to him.
Walt!
Shrieked Liz as she saw the body. When she tried to push past them, Kelly held her back.
You can't, Liz. This is a crime scene now. I'm sorry.
She punched and slapped at him until Kelly pinned her arms to her sides. She slumped against him, sobbing. Decker looked first at Kelly and then at the dead man.
Well, I didn't see that one coming.
Chapter 43. The room at the police station contained three people, but was quiet other than the sounds of commingled breathing. Decker, Jameson, and Kelly sat there staring at the scuffed linoleum tile floor. It was early in the morning, the dawn not yet broken, and Walt Southern's body was on a gurney in his funeral home. A stricken Liz Southern was at the home of friends. Another coroner from Williston was traveling to do the post, though everyone in the room knew the exact cause of the man's death. He had scrawled a note, which they'd found on his desk.
I'm sorry for everything. I hate myself.
He obviously had chosen not to finish it.
So why? Asked Kelly. Was he really compromised?
Decker said,
Clearly somebody made him fudge the post results to throw us off. First, with Kramer having ingested something, and then with Ames's going out there to meet with Parker. It wasn't for sex. It was for information. They blackmailed Walt to leave out the parts of the autopsy that would have led us to know that.
Do you think Walt really was blackmailed? Asked Kelly. Maybe they just paid him off.
People doing this sort of thing for cash don't usually blow their heads off when they're discovered. They try to cut a deal by ratting on whoever paid them. And despite what I told Southern, we had no direct proof that he did anything intentionally wrong. I just called him on it, and he reacted the way he did. It was clearly because of a guilty conscience. Just look at the suicide note. Sorry for everything. I hate myself.
He added,
But I didn't think he'd kill himself over it. I was clearly wrong about that.
So what did he have a guilty conscience about?
Asked Jameson.
For that, we're going to have to talk to his wife, answered Decker.
Later that evening, Liz Southern looked pale and worn as she sat up in the bed of a guest room in a house belonging to a close friend of hers. She cradled a large cup of tea, and her bloodshot eyes spoke of the misery she was enduring. She looked at Decker with an unfriendly gaze as he sat down next to the bed. Kelly and Jameson stood immediately behind him.
You couldn't wait even one damn day,
she said harshly.
My husband killed himself.
If we could wait, we would, but we can't. So anything you can tell us will be much appreciated.
I don't know why Walt did what he did.
Decker leaned forward in his chair.
Then let's work through it together, starting with what he wrote in that note.
Southern closed her eyes and sighed.
It's important, Liz, chimed in Kelly.
I know that, Joe,
she snapped, her eyes now open and blazing at him. Decker cleared his throat.
If Walt was forced to fudge the autopsy results for Kramer and Ames, we need to know how and by whom.
I have no idea why he would do that. I still don't believe that he did intentionally mess up those reports. If it's anyone's fault he's dead, it's yours. You accused him of all those terrible things.
Decker sat back, not looking convinced.
If the guy was innocent of what I accused him, no way he's taking his own life. Before he walked out of the room, he mentioned his lawyer. That's not a guy looking to off himself over what I said.
Then why would he kill himself instead of calling his lawyer?
She shot back.
I think he was just blustering,
grasping at anything he could in the heat of the moment. I think as he walked to his office, reality set in, and that's when he made his decision.
You really want me to provide dirt on my dead husband? Is that what you're asking me to do?
She added shrilly. What I'm asking you to do is help us solve a series of murders, and whoever blackmailed your husband and drove him to kill himself deserves to be punished. We need your help to get to them.
Well, if you hadn't accused him like you did,
she began. If I missed something like that, I'm in the wrong line of work, Decker interjected. You know something of the forensic business. Do you think he could have really missed big items like that on two separate posts? Southern drew a deep breath and settled a shrewd gaze on him.
I think you're in the exact line of work you should be in, Agent Decker.
Okay, he said expectantly. Southern reached out and plunked a tissue from a box on the nightstand. She dabbed at her eyes and blew her nose before crumpling the tissue in her hand.
My husband was a good man.
I'm not suggesting he was a bad guy, said Decker.
But he had issues.
What sort of issues? The woman's eyes welled up with tears.
He was into some things that others, particularly around here, might have found troubling.
What sort of things are we talking about?
Was it something criminal? Said Kelly.
No, but it would have done a lot of damage to his reputation.
She let out a long breath.
He was having an affair with the wife of a friend.
She clutched the edge of the sheet, and her eyes filled with tears.
How did you find out? Asked Kelly.
Text messages. Something I saw on his computer. Late-night phone calls, and I had him followed.
Did you confront him about it? Asked Decker.
She grabbed another tissue and wiped her eyes.
Yes. At first he denied everything, said I was mistaken, said it was all a misunderstanding. But he finally admitted it. We talked about getting a divorce, but we hadn't gotten around to it yet.
That must have put a strain on your marriage,
said Jameson.
I finally told myself to ignore it. He did what he wanted, and so did I. We have no children, so I would get glammed up and go out and have some drinks, and if I didn't come back at night and I was in someone else's bed, so what?
That night I saw you at the bar, said Decker.
I left you to attend to just such an appointment,
said Southern, avoiding their gazes. Decker moved a bit closer to her.
So someone else might have found out about his affair. They might have sent him photos or other incriminating evidence and threatened him with exposure if he didn't do what they said.
It's certainly possible,
Jameson said.
But people do have affairs. Would the threat of exposure be enough to make him alter post-mortem reports? He had to know that whoever wanted him to do that might have had a hand in the murders.
Walt was a very proud man, a very upstanding citizen of this town. I agree that it seems crazy that he would do the bidding of what could be a murderer in order to keep his reputation intact, but I also know that's what he did.
Who was he having an affair with? Asked Kelly.
Southern shook her head.
No, I'm not going to tell you. It has nothing to do with the murders.
You don't know that, said Kelly.
But Southern shook her head.
Decker took all this in and said,
Did he mention anything, even in passing, that might shed some light on who was making him do this?
I've been racking my brain trying to think of just that,
she said.
And I can't come up with anything.
She sank back against the pillow and closed her eyes.
Chapter 44. Jameson and Decker dropped Kelly off at the police station and drove back to their hotel. Along the way, Jameson said,
We've got 3 people dead, 2 murdered and 1 suicide, including the coroner who did the post on the other 2 and screwed them both up because he was possibly being blackmailed for sexual indiscretions. And the guy who found the first body is missing and presumed dead. What a mess.
And an old man in a nursing home who knows a lot but won't tell us anything, added Decker, gazing moodily out the window.
I agree that Kramer came here possibly because of what Brad Daniels told her. But if he won't reveal to us what he might have told her, what do? We can't waterboard the guy.
We can threaten him with obstruction and put him in prison, pointed out Decker.
A 90-something-year-old war veteran in a nursing home, really? Do you see the FBI or a court doing that?
The phone that Roby had left him started to vibrate. He pulled it out of his pocket and hit the green button.
Yeah, Roby?
Roby said, be at this address in a half hour. He gave the destination and clicked off. Decker looked at Jameson, who said,
what?
Change of plan.
He punched the address into his phone, and they set off. It was 15 miles outside of town at what looked to be an abandoned apartment building.
I guess this was a casualty of the last bust,
said Jameson as she pulled their SUV to a stop in front of the structure and they climbed out.
So where's this Roby guy?
Roby stepped out from the shadows of the front entrance and called out softly to them.
Follow me.
He led them down a covered walkway that led to the rear of the building. He opened a door there and motioned them inside. As she passed him, Jameson said,
nice to meet you, Roby.
He simply nodded. Inside, Roby closed and locked the door and led them past an empty, stained pool and down an interior corridor, illuminating the way with a small tack light. He opened another interior door and motioned them in. When he closed the door behind him, a small light came on in the room, brightening it, if feebly. In a chair sat Blue Man, dressed in a regulation suit and tie that would have allowed him to blend in at most any event in Washington, D.C., but made him stick out conspicuously in London, North Dakota.
Mr. Decker, Agent Jameson, please sit, said Blue Man.
Who the hell are you? Said Decker.
A wise question. Your phone should be buzzing any moment.
Ah.
Decker lifted out his vibrating cell phone and hit the answer button.
Ross? What's going? What?
Decker glanced at Blue Man.
Yeah, we are. Okay. You sure? Right. Thanks.
He clicked off and looked at Jameson.
Bogart says this guy is on the up and up, and we should listen to him.
Jameson nodded and noted that Roby stood with his back to the door they had come through.
I don't think we have a choice anyway,
she said, studying Roby's granite expression. Blue Man motioned to the two chairs in front of him.
Please.
They sat. Blue Man said,
I understand there have been developments.
If you call the coroner on the case offing himself a development, then yes, there have been developments, said Decker curtly.
And the reason? Said Blue Man.
His wife thought it possible that he was being blackmailed for sexual indiscretions,
said Jameson.
And you believe her? Said Blue Man.
I don't believe anybody just because they tell me something, said Decker, and I'm not sure if present company is excluded or not.
I would have been disappointed had you answered otherwise, said Blue Man benignly. Any other developments?
I've got somebody tracking down Ben Purdy. He has family in Montana.
The ticking time bomb, as you told my colleague.
Yes.
Any thoughts on that?
Yeah. All of them apocalyptic.
Decker paused and studied Blue Man.
And you're involved in this, why? Because you don't strike me as the law enforcement type.
I have no authority whatsoever to do anything in this country. Neither does Roby.
Well, you've run right over that rule.
That certainly is one interpretation. Anything else?
We think Pamela Ames was the target, not Hal Parker.
Why?
They tried to make it seem that she was there servicing Parker as a hooker, but I believe that was fabricated.
Why would they do that? Asked Roby.
To explain away why Ames was at Parker's house. If it wasn't for sex, then why? She lived at the colony. She would have known Irene Kramer. It's perfectly plausible that when Ames left the colony, she would reach out to Kramer for assistance. In fact, I think she did. And it might have been then that Kramer told Ames something that later made Ames suspicious. Whoever killed Kramer might be very worried that Ames knew something that could lead back to them. And it's also possible that they might have had reason to get rid of Parker. It was a stroke of genius to get them both out of the way at the same time and make it seem like Parker was the only target and Ames was in the wrong place at the wrong time.
What would Parker have known that could hurt them? Asked Blue Man.
He was a trained tracker. He found the body before the rains started. Now, the killer had to get the body out there, and it couldn't have been lying out there long at all because it hadn't been attacked by animals. So I doubt the killer carried her for miles to place her there, and the ground out there is relatively soft.
So he would have left tracks, noted Roby.
Yes, and if he did, maybe Parker saw them.
But why wouldn't he have told the police about that if he did?
Wondered Jameson.
Now that's an interesting question, said Decker, because it opens lots of possibilities.
Interesting, said Blue Man. Very interesting.
Is this a two-way street? Asked Decker.
Meaning?
What can you tell us?
Blue Man nodded slowly and looked thoughtful. I think some quid pro quo is in order. You asked why I'm involved, and ultimately why you and Agent Jameson are involved in this. He paused. Irene Kramer is the answer, of course.
Or Mary Rice, as she was known at a nursing home in Williston,
interjected Jameson. Blue Man said, or Terry Ellison, or Denise Finley. I could go on and on.
Please do,
encouraged Jameson. Irene Kramer was collateral damage in a disastrous mission undertaken decades ago by the U.S. government.
How so? Asked Decker.
Her mother was a Russian agent.
Jameson shot Decker a glance.
Sins of the parent, Decker, like you said.
Oh, so you had figured that out, said Blue Man.
Only to that extent. So her mother was a spy and you caught her. How is that a disaster?
You didn't let me finish. Her mother was a Russian agent who we thought was still working against us. She was actually a double agent and was working on behalf of a sister agency of ours that had neglected to tell us of that arrangement.
And the FBI's involvement? Because Kramer's fingerprints set off alarm bells all over Bureau land.
They were the agency tasked with bringing Kramer's mother in, since we have no authority to arrest anyone.
What happened?
Asked Jameson. Irene Kramer was only 8 at the time. I won't tell you what their real names were. The point is the mission went sideways and her mother was killed. And unfortunately, Irene saw the whole disturbing thing.
And her mother was working for us?
Said Jameson.
Risking her life?
What a clusterfuck, added Decker.
Yes, it was. We could not let her daughter go back to Russia, of course. So for all intents and purposes, we adopted her, gave her a new identity, paid for her education and living expenses, gave her money when she needed it as she grew up.
You were paying for her silence?
Said Jameson harshly. In a way, yes, though who would have believed her? But the far more important thing was to keep her safe. The Russians have a long memory, and were they to find out about her mother spying on them, which we believe they actually did, Moscow would have no compunction about using the daughter as an example. She would have died a horrible death, I can assure you.
Did you know she was applying for a teaching job here?
Asked Jameson.
She told the brothers that she went to Amherst, and she had a teaching certificate. They apparently didn't check up on that because they needed someone badly.
Normally, if she needed a reference for some reason, the information she provided an employer would run through one of our departments, which would handle it.
So you would give her a bogus reference, said Decker incredulously.
It's not like she ever applied to be a commercial airline pilot or heart surgeon, and as a matter of fact, she had gone to college at Amherst, and she did have a teaching certificate under the name Irene Kramer. Decker looked at Blue Man.
But you knew nothing about her applying for the job here?
Blue Man shook his head and said, About 14 months ago, she disappeared off our radar completely. That had never happened before. We were concerned, of course.
That's just about the time she stopped working at the nursing home,
noted Jameson.
So when her prints and the name hit the FBI database, said Decker,
we knew what had become of her, but we don't know who killed her.
Or why she was here, said Decker.
Precisely.
There's an old man at that nursing home named Brad Daniels who worked at the London Air Station decades ago. Irene, under the name Mary Rice, worked as a physical therapist and met Daniels that way.
We actually knew about her job at the nursing home, said Blue Man. We paid for PT training for her.
I think she continually changed occupations just to make us do things for her, provide her education and money.
She must have hated you all very much,
pointed out Jameson. No doubt she did, as I would have if the positions were reversed. But this elderly gentleman, Daniels, explain, please.
Decker said, we talked to him. He clammed up when we asked him about the work he'd done here, said it was classified.
And when Decker told him that Mary Rice had been murdered, he lost it, screamed at us to get out.
You think he told her something? That's why she came here?
This comment came from Roby. Decker and Jameson both nodded.
That's right,
she said.
And perhaps he feels guilt for what happened to her, said Blue Man, which might have caused his anger.
Decker looked at Blue Man. What do you know about the Douglas S. George Defense Complex?
The Air Force, in theory, runs it, but it is odd.
What is?
Asked Jameson.
There's a similar facility on the other side of North Dakota. The one here was constructed in the 50s, the other one in the 60s. The latter only operated for a very short time before being decommissioned. Its original mission had fallen into disfavor, and its price tag became too costly. But it still tracks the skies with its Parks radar array.
Just like the one here,
said Jameson.
Yes.
So they're redundant, noted Decker.
Exactly.
In addition to the ambulances and the men Roby saw being wheeled away, we talked to a farmer who lives right next to the facility.
Decker went on to explain what Robert White had seen that night.
That is quite disturbing, said Blue Man.
But maybe enlightening, too, suggested Decker.
Illuminating, at the very least, replied Blue Man. Roby?
Yes, sir.
We'll need to check that out. Now.
Right. Roby left.
Blue Man looked back at Decker.
This is obviously far more than a murder investigation. I'm just a cop doing his job.
I have no doubt that you will do your job, Mr. Decker, and your country needs you to.
If this sucker is that critical, why don't you call in the big boys?
Blue Man looked at him with calm resignation.
The problem is, Mr. Decker, I strongly suspect they're already here.
Chapter 45. Decker and Jameson drove back to London. When they got there, they passed by a sleek six-story apartment building that looked fairly new.
Isn't that Hugh Dawson?
Said Jameson. The man was climbing out of a late-model black Range Rover.
Yeah, it is.
He's out late.
They watched as Dawson looked furtively around and then strode through the front door and into the building.
Pull over, said Decker.
Jameson parked at the curb and they got out. Jameson followed Decker into the building. There was a concierge desk, and they heard elevator doors closing as they approached it. A young woman was at the desk, dressed in a trim dark blue uniform with a name tag that read Sarah. She said,
May I help you?
Decker and Jameson approached the desk. Decker said,
Sarah, we work for Mr. Dawson. We know he was scheduled to be here. I think we might have just missed him.
He patted his jacket pocket.
We have some papers he needed. He forgot them and called us to bring them to him.
You did just miss him. He's already gone up in the elevator. I can take them up.
Decker frowned and shook his head.
I'm sure you're perfectly reliable, but Mr. Dawson is very particular, and these documents are confidential. If he knew I gave them to an unauthorized person, I'd be out of a job.
The woman looked at Jameson.
He's not kidding,
said Jameson.
Well, all right, I guess it's okay. He went up to number 503.
Right, that's...
He looked helplessly at Jameson.
Crap, I forgot the guy's name.
He glanced apologetically at the concierge.
Mr. Dawson does so many deals, it's hard to keep them all straight.
She smiled and said,
It's Mr. McClellan's apartment.
Exactly. I knew that's who it had to be. Good old Stuart McClellan. Well, thanks.
They got on the elevator and took it up to the fifth floor.
Dawson is meeting secretly with McClellan?
Said Jameson.
Not so secret if the concierge knows about it, replied Decker.
What do you think is going on?
Those binders he had on his desk? He told us he was working on some big deal. Maybe that deal is with McClellan.
But I thought they didn't get along.
Lots of people who don't get along still do deals together.
You think this has something to do with our investigation?
It's possible. People have been killed and abducted. Walt Southern was blackmailed. Parker was hired by Hugh Dawson. He and McClellan are the two wealthiest men around. It wouldn't be the first time murder has been tied to money.
They got off the elevator and walked down to number 503, where Decker knocked on the door. They could hear footsteps coming and the door opened. Stuart McClellan's tie was unknotted and the buttons of his vest were undone. He had on a pair of reading glasses that were perched halfway down his nose. He looked up at them in confusion.
What the hell are you doing here? How did you even get up here?
Before Decker could say anything, Jameson stepped forward.
We're federal agents investigating a murder. Do you really think a concierge is going to keep us at bay?
Decker glanced at Jameson with admiration. Next, he peered over McClellan's head when he heard movement in the room.
We understand that you're not alone.
What business is that of yours? Snarled McClellan.
Can we come in?
No,
barked McClellan. Jameson said,
Fine, we'll keep eyes on the place until we get a warrant issued.
On what grounds? Snapped McClellan.
On the grounds that you're harboring a witness who we need to speak to right now. Did you hear that, Mr. Dawson?
Jameson added in a raised voice. Dawson came around a corner and stood behind McClellan. He looked both pissed off and weary at the same time.
What do you need to speak to me about? He said.
Do you want to do this out in the hallway? Said Decker. I would have thought you'd want some privacy.
McClellan glanced at Dawson, who shrugged. The apartment was spacious and luxuriously furnished. Decker had noted, as they came down the hall, that they'd passed number 509 and had not seen another door until they came to 503. So McClellan had apparently cobbled together several units into one. He looked around and said,
Nice place.
Why are you here? Demanded McClellan. We're busy.
With what?
Asked Decker.
That is none of your business, retorted McClellan. Federal agents or not, he added, looking spitefully at Jameson.
Decker eyed Dawson.
He was at your hotel that night. You're working on this big deal, you said. You told us that McClellan finally has his business model right, which means maybe no more booms and busts for him, and you've been acquiring property on the cheap. Now you're meeting secretly?
Jameson said to Dawson,
You're selling out to McClellan, aren't you?
Dawson eyed McClellan.
Guess the cat's out of the bag, Sue.
We don't care what you're doing with McClellan, said Decker. And this will go no farther, he added, when McClellan looked like he was about to erupt in anger.
Dawson slipped his hands into his pants pockets.
Then what do you care about?
I've got two murders, one suicide, and a missing person.
Suicide, said McClellan.
Walt Southern ate a bullet.
McClellan looked at him goggle-eyed.
Walt? Why?
We don't know yet. Maybe a guilty conscience. Did you know him well?
I knew him, but we weren't close or anything.
Decker eyed Dawson, who changed expression when he caught Decker's gaze.
Guilty conscience? Said Dawson. What for?
Can you think of a reason?
No, and I didn't really know the man well enough to have knowledge of any demons that might have led to his killing himself.
Surely he would have done your wife's funeral.
Dawson's eyes narrowed at this provocative statement.
So what if he did? That wouldn't make us best friends.
So Walt Southern did the autopsy on her?
Yes, and it was confirmed that she died from carbon monoxide poisoning, and...
Dawson stopped and stared at Decker.
What are you implying?
I'm not implying anything. And what did Alice Pritchard die of?
Exposure. She apparently tried to make it to her car when Maddie didn't show up. They found her outside, frozen stiff.
And the text your wife sent you?
I was in France with Caroline. We didn't see it until the following morning. By then it was too late.
He looked away. Jameson said,
That's what Caroline told us.
How is Liz Southern? Asked Dawson slowly.
Shaken, distraught, as you would imagine,
answered Jameson.
You know her? Asked Decker.
Walt moved here about 20 years ago and started his business, but Liz is from London. Our families knew each other. Her parents are dead now, and she and Walt live, well, now she lives in town. But she still has her parents' farmhouse about 10 miles outside of town. And she and Caroline have become good friends over the years. Liz is older than Caroline, of course, doesn't have any siblings, and never had any children. I think she sees Caroline as a younger sister.
McClellan interjected. So now can you get on with your investigation and leave us to our business? Decker eyed Dawson. Caroline is very proud of her new restaurant. Does that get sold to this guy too?
McClellan said sharply, This is private business.
Again, an answer in itself.
Dawson said, Don't worry, Caroline will be just fine.
I wouldn't bet the farm on it, replied Decker. Chapter 46 Long-range night optics were Will Roby's best friend. He was lying prone, sighting through one of his favorite pieces of surveillance hardware. It didn't match the eyesight of the radar array facility he was watching currently, but it was more than good enough for his purposes. He'd been here for an hour, and during that time had barely moved. Being able to lie motionless and intensely focused on his target for inordinately long periods of time was Roby's bread and butter. Without it, he couldn't do his job. Vector guards continued to make their rounds. A small jet had landed about an hour before. He couldn't see who had gotten off. Before that, two choppers had lifted off the ground, and one had returned. A few vehicles had left the facility through the main gate, but all had returned. He watched another car head toward the front gate. He zeroed in on Colonel Mark Sumter as the driver. Roby had been briefed on him and seen multiple photos of the man. Sumter was alone in the vehicle, and he was not in uniform. Where might the colonel be going at this late hour? Roby collapsed the tripod holding his scope and sprinted to his electric scooter. He timed it so he would hit the road Sumter was on about 10 seconds after the man passed that spot. He pulled in behind Sumter with his lights off. He had slipped on a pair of night vision goggles, enabling him to see clearly without exposing himself by using his headlight. Sumter drove straight down the road, not turning off at any intersection, until he was about 5 miles from downtown London. Then he hung a left down a windy gravel road. In the distance, as he rounded a sharp curve, Roby could see a small house with a light on. There was a large tree out front. Roby pulled off the road and set his scooter down on its side in some tall grass. He made the rest of his way to the house on foot. He performed a sweep of the property, looking for sentries, but saw none. He took up a surveillance position behind the tree, which was set about 10 feet from the front door. There was no other vehicle in front of the house other than Sumter's car. A minute later, Roby quietly made his way to the front window, where the light was shining through. The window was closed, but the curtains were not fully shut. Through a sliver of an opening, Roby could see the profile of a man. He was in his late 60s, jowly and gray-haired, and dressed in a conservative dark suit with a blue and red unknotted tie. Roby took the man's picture with a thumb-sized camera and next pulled from his pocket a device that looked like an extra-long pen with a wired earbud attached to one end. He pressed the other end, which had a small suction cup attached, against the glass, and inserted the bud in his ear. Voices filtered into his ear.
The intrusion is concerning, Colonel, said the older man. It's not something that was anticipated.
Roby next heard Sumter's response.
We don't know what they wanted. The SUV was untraceable. It's not just concerning, it's my ass on the line, after all. Don't let your nerves run away with you. It'll be fine. Again, my ass is on the line. All of our asses are on the line, but what we're doing is for the greater good. You agree with that, don't you? National security and all? Yes, otherwise I wouldn't be here. Then we just have to redouble our security efforts and keep our heads down. I can run interference for you in Washington. You have our full backing. And Vector? They do their job and they do it well. Enough said. But what if someone's found who can, well, blow everything up? It's true there is not complete alignment on this issue, but I think even if the American people found out, they would not be troubled. Jesus, we can't go take a poll. This is all classified.
Maybe the most classified thing I've ever been involved in. The same could be said for me, although I've been in this business far longer than you. Now the FBI came to see you with questions. I'm executive lagging that, and in the end, I won't get back to them. I'll blame it on DOD security protocols. I think that's wise. I can help with that as well. I have high-up contacts at the Bureau. Whatever got that tail wagging, I can put the kibosh on it. That would be greatly appreciated. Sumter paused. You know, we could have just spoken on the phone. These late-night meetings could raise suspicion. No, we could not talk on the phone, no matter how secure it might be. Emails, texts, phone calls, all of that can be captured and then used against someone. These meetings, face-to-face, no record exists. The man paused. Except in the memories of each of us. Sumter seemed to get the man's meaning. I'm never going to talk to anyone about this. The man nodded. Everything else is fine? No concerns? The ones I've already told you are concerns enough for me, but the rest of the operation is fine, yes. Good. Well, I will put my efforts into motion, and you will do what I have advised. Until next week, then, I'll let you know where and when. Roby retreated to about 50 yards from the house and watched as Sumter came out, climbed into his car, and drove off. When the other man did not appear, Roby drew closer to the house and waited. He did not have to wait long. He fell back and hunched down as the sound of the chopper came closer. He saw the blinking lights from the belly of the aircraft. Next, a searchlight flitted over the house and yard as Roby quickly lay flat in the high grass, face down. He only lifted his head when he could tell by the sounds of the engine reducing power and the whomp-whomp of the chopper's props lessening that the aircraft was landing. The front door of the house opened up, and the older gent came out, crossed the yard quickly, and climbed into a rear door of the chopper. It immediately lifted off, as Roby shot pictures of all of it. A minute later, he was back on his scooter, flying down the road toward town. He wanted to report in with Blue Man. It would prove to be far more difficult than he had thought. Chapter 47.
But does that have anything to do with our case?
Asked Jameson as they sat in the hotel lobby late that night. It's not a crime for Hugh Dawson to sell out to Stuart McClellan, noted Decker. But to answer your question, I don't know if there is a connection. Yet.
Do you think McClellan is involved in this somehow?
If Irene Kramer knew something that was damaging to him, it's possible. I just don't know what that might be. But I think the military installation is a more promising suspect. I think that's why she came up here.
There's clearly something going on over there,
said Jameson.
From what Roby found out and our discussion with his boss.
We need to talk to Brad Daniels again.
And Roby's boss seems to think that something is off there. I mean, why have two redundant facilities in North Dakota?
So the one here has an ulterior purpose. The guy running away that Robert White saw, said Decker.
Yeah?
The guy was obviously trying to escape.
So you think there's some sort of prison being operated over there?
Maybe.
And the ambulances?
It seems to be the sort of prison where people suffer injury routinely enough to require medical attention off-site.
But if they are operating a prison over there, where would they take the injured prisoners? I mean, if they're trying to keep it secret, they can't just drive them to the local hospital.
They have a runway. They have choppers coming and going at odd hours. Jameson looked at him in alarm.
You think they're flying these guys out?
And maybe they don't come back.
Decker, all of that sounds really illegal. I mean, you can't hurt prisoners, fly them out, and then they disappear. They have rights.
Maybe they're not ordinary prisoners, Alex. She gaped at him.
Meaning what?
It's a military facility. Maybe they're military prisoners of a sort.
But if they are military prisoners, they still have rights.
Maybe they're not members of the military, or even American citizens. Remember White said the guy was talking gibberish.
He said he thought the guy was nuts, or maybe on drugs.
Or maybe speaking a foreign language.
Are you saying what I think you're saying?
Maybe they're running another Guantanamo up here in North Dakota. Jameson slumped back in her seat.
Another Gitmo? Here?
You wouldn't want to transfer a bunch of enemy combatants or terrorists to New York City or another really populated area. And if this facility is redundant, it would be the perfect place.
Right. And then Vector is brought in to handle security.
Decker nodded. They show up here, and the Air Force people get kicked out, leaving Sumter as the sole remaining flag bearer to give it a modicum of respect. I think Vector was brought in to watch over the people they're keeping there, and maybe interrogating them to the point of their being injured.
But that's not allowed anymore.
Says who? Replied Decker sharply. Jameson started to reply, but then seemed to think better of it. He eased forward in his chair. It would also explain why Roby is on the scene.
But they told us why. It was because of what happened to Irene Kramer's mother.
Decker shook his head. Roby's boss struck me as one real heavyweight. And Roby, too. Maybe they're upset that Kramer got killed after what happened to her mother under their watch. But feeling guilty isn't a reason to bring those kind of assets up here. There's something else. Another reason why they're here. Jameson snapped her fingers.
Roby's boss said that some big players may already be on the scene here, and that clearly was a problem.
If they're running a secret prison, engaging in illegal interrogation, I think that would qualify as something people would kill to keep quiet about. He tapped his fingers against the arm of his chair. The only problem is that theory doesn't square with why Kramer came here in the first place. Daniels told her something about that facility, but that was from a long time ago. Long before Vector or any potential prisoners showed up there.
So you mean there has to be something else going on, namely, whatever Daniels told Kramer that compelled her to move here?
Decker nodded. But if Kramer came up here to find out something about that facility based on what Daniels told her, and then stumbled onto what they're doing now?
That's a motive to kill her. But why slice open her stomach and intestines?
Her mother was a spy. Maybe she taught her kid to swallow secrets, or she saw her mother do it before. The people who killed Kramer might have somehow known this and cut her open to get it back. Then they tried to hide that by performing a post-mortem on her and also blackmailing Walt Southern.
But why leave the body out there like that? I mean, they could have buried it somewhere. No one would have found her and we'd never have been called in.
Well, one explanation is that they didn't know about her past. Local murder, local cops working on it, not the FBI. If it came out she was a prostitute, the local cops would have chalked it up to that. And if they had blackmailed Southern to mess with the postmortems, the cops wouldn't have probably even focused on the stomach and intestines. I had to read that report 3 times to find a reference to it.
I'm surprised he even referred to it at all.
Guy was covering his ass in case this all came out. He could say, hey, it's right there. Even if I didn't highlight it or take photos of that specific region. I checked for contraband and found none. And the liver mortis miscue? He could chalk that up to not being a full-time pathologist. No, he was hedging his bets all right.
So they would have found her body, done the post, conducted the investigation, and come up with zip.
Which is better for them than no one finding her. And the cops keep digging and maybe call in other resources to try to find her. The fact that she was a prostitute, or at least holding herself out as one, would make for an easy answer for the cops. It's a high-risk profession. Women like that get murdered all the time, and their bodies get dumped. Cops poke around and then move on to the next case.
That does make sense.
Well, that's something, since nothing else in this damn case makes the least bit of sense, growled Decker. Chapter 48. Roby parked the scooter outside the same abandoned apartment building where he had taken Decker and Jameson to meet Blue Man. His boss wasn't here, but Roby had secure communications inside the building to contact him. And Roby had also made this derelict place his home base for now. The sound reached his ears a few seconds before it would have been picked up by anyone not as well trained as he was. Seconds of warning meant he got to live another day. Maybe. He immediately flitted for cover near the building's front doors and pulled his pistol. There were at least 5 men that he could see. Where they had come from, he couldn't tell. Most likely, they had already been here before he arrived, which meant his hiding place had been compromised. In the moonlight, he could see that they wore light armor and carried automatic, combat-grade weaponry. They were advancing in a diamond-shaped attack pattern. There was no way he could fire at one without revealing his location, and his cover position could not withstand concentrated counterfire. This dilemma presented a clear tactical first step. Since his current position was indefensible, he moved. He was through the front doors and up the stairs before any of them could gain a line of sight on him to fire. Any building that Will Roby had ever occupied had been thoroughly researched by him beforehand, and this one was no exception. He turned left and sprinted down the hall that bisected the main floor. He reached the rear doors, knelt, and peered out. Tack lights and gun muzzles were coming his way. They were smart enough to have cut off his rear exit. This op had involved some planning. He heard the front doors open. Roby hit the stairwell, running up three flights of stairs, popped through the door, and hustled down the hall to the last room on the left. He unlocked the door and then bolted it behind him. He raced to the window, even as he heard the reverberations of multiple feet pounding up the stairs. He never thought about calling anyone for help, because there really wasn't anyone to call. And even if there were, they would never get here in time. Roby had to rely on himself, which was nothing new for him. He opened the window and pulled out a coil of rope that he had earlier placed behind a piece of furniture. There was also a small duffel with some things that might prove helpful, along with his comm equipment. He slung the duffel over his shoulder and tied the rope to the railing that ran around the small balcony attached to the side of the building. He looked down and now saw no tack lights or other signs of someone being down there. They must have entered the building already. In the distance, he saw the blinking lights of an aircraft as it zipped across the clear sky. The flare lights of the oil fields burned far away, looking like clusters of shiny objects. He slipped over the side of the balcony, and using his legs around the rope as stabilizers, he methodically made his way down. As soon as his feet touched dirt, he took out his weapon, screwed a suppressor can onto the muzzle, knelt down, took aim, and shot the man who had just come around the corner. The fellow dropped silently to the ground, but the sound of the suppressed round seemed to boom across the flat, dark land like cannon fire. What was up was now coming down, as from inside the building, Roby heard the sounds of feet charging down to the first floor. He sprinted to his left, even as gunfire rained down on him from above. They also had the high ground now, which was the best ground to possess. Fired rounds careened off the stucco hide of the building, and shrapnel flew off like little whirlwinds of twisted metal. Roby felt one slice into his arm, but he never slowed until he reached the man he'd killed. In one smooth motion, he jerked the man up and used him as a shield while he grabbed the loaded subgun out of his hands, along with three spare 30-round mags from ammo sleeves in his pants. As rounds slammed into the dead man, Roby waited for a pause in the firing, then dropped the body and sprinted around the corner of the building. Reaching the front, Roby threw himself forward in a prone position and opened fire right as the group of closely masked men erupted from the front entrance. Because of the body armor they wore, he employed only headshots, and in short order had taken out all five who had burst into his range. Those not instantly dead moaned, cried, and cursed as Roby rose and sprinted toward his scooter. He heard another sound that caused him to change direction and then dive down, right as the bullets zipped over him. He rolled right, took aim, and strafed the field in front of him with gunfire. This would give him a few precious seconds to assess the new threat. It was coming from two directions, 90 and 270 on the compass. Looked to be six men in each group, armed and armored. Roby felt flattered they had sent basically a platoon to take him out. He fired off the rest of his mag to keep his enemy at bay for another few seconds, and then slammed in his next-to-last sleeve of ammo. His scooter was out of the question now. His adversaries owned that ground. He couldn't run for it. They would cut him down in a matter of seconds. No help was coming. He was outnumbered 10-1, and he had 2 30-round mags and 7 additional shots in his pistol. They probably had thousands of rounds to expend on him